I want to thank Mark Grimsley for inviting me and doing the work to put this together. I know it was a lot of energy and effort, and I do appreciate it. And I'm really happy that so many of you have come out tonight. I wish we were here to discuss a happier topic, but I'm really pleased at how much interest there is in a very important topic and a very difficult one, I think. I've been doing a lot of speaking on this around the country this past year, and I've learned the formula for a very successful talk, and it's to have a really great opening and a really terrific finish, and to have them as close together as possible. And I don't know that I'll even go 20 minutes, but I thought I would follow my assignment, which was to lay out the broad contours of the circumstance we face now in Iraq and sort of take a retrospective look quickly at how we got here and how much of what we set out to accomplish we've done, and is there any roadmap forward for us? And if there is, what does it look like? I think it's good to draw back for just a minute as we start and remind ourselves of what it is we were trying to accomplish. We're deeply engaged now in a complex and difficult war. And in the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've come down from 40,000 feet, in my view, to the vivid individual issues of war. And the media now is no longer portraying this in large numbers and from a wide-angled lens of just bombing or the broad sweep at the macro level. We're down to what's very vivid, whether it's the beheading today or the prisoner scandal yesterday or the coffins 10 days ago. And it's very clear that vivid images of war stir deep emotions. Public relations people on all sides of this issue understand that. They also understand people don't get as moved by broad sweeping statistics, even if those broad sweeping statistics are much more shocking, actually, from a humanitarian perspective. It takes the vivid individual story, and we get wrapped up in trying to win. And we're now in the midst of a pretty intense fight. Obviously, people want to win, and it's very tactical level thinking without a lot of attention to what it is we were trying to accomplish. And so I want to start there. I think we went to Iraq and hoped that three things would turn out a year later. We hoped that the United States would not face the threat of weapons of mass destruction used by anyone in Iraq. Now, it turned out the threat was not as great as anyone back then thought. So you could say mission accomplished if you wanted. There wasn't much to accomplish, it turned out, in the long run. But in terms of that factor, at least we found out that they're unlikely. The second was we hoped to sever any links there were between the regime in Iraq and al-Qaeda. And we hoped to reduce the likelihood to zero that the Iraqi regime would be able to provide weapons, money, or any other kinds of opportunity to terrorists who might attack in the United States or attack allies of the United States in the Middle East. Again, it turns out the linkages between those terror organizations related to al-Qaeda and the regime in Baghdad were very unclear before and seem no clearer now. The linkage between that regime and groups resisting Israeli occupation were strong before and are weaker now or non-existent now. Unfortunately, because of the way the last year has unfolded, fighters supportive of al-Qaeda have come into Iraq and into Fallujah and elsewhere in the country. And so in many ways, we've created as big a terror problem in Iraq as we've solved, at least within that country alone. And I think the last thing we hoped to accomplish was to initiate a process of change where in one Arab state, at least, there'd be movement away from authoritarian government and in the direction of some sort of democratic regime, hopefully one that would even be pro-American or at least friendly to America, grateful that it had knocked off the dictatorial regime of the past and allowed some communities in the society, for instance the Shia, to enjoy a greater say in governance. We also hoped that maybe in that environment, other areas of the Middle East would be moving in a direction that would be more friendly to the United States. It's on this score, I think, the record is the most mixed, and we need to talk about the hardest or in the most detail, because it's not at all clear that by our actions we're in a good position now to hope for a democratic Iraq, or if we get a democratic Iraq, that it would be very pro-American. At this time, we may be able to choose one or the other, but not both. The resistance, let me start with just where are we militarily? The resistance was easily defeated because there really wasn't much fighting a year ago. The army wasn't defeated, it just disintegrated and went home. We're now facing actually growing resistance rather than declining resistance. And from the outset, the view often heard in Washington was that the resistance we faced were small pockets of Saddam loyalists, and after that, foreign fighters who were infiltrating to support the Saddamists or Al-Qaeda. Now, after the killing of Saddam's two sons and then his own capture, it became less and less credible that the continued resistance was attributable to those, and each time the argument was that now that this sort of benchmark has been reached, the violence would go down, and instead the violence has gone up. Also, the violence was originally thought to reside primarily in the areas north of Baghdad, where there's a large concentration of Sunni, many of whom have been important members of the previous regime, or at least favored in the former Ba'athist government. And they were particularly reticent to give up the privileges of the past, and they felt the fall from grace the hardest. And certainly in Fallujah, we've seen a lot of resistance. What is now more difficult for us is the resistance has spread widely. It's now also quite evident in the South, which we hoped would be the most grateful. And it's become clear that a number of Shia organizations, which we'd hoped would be our allies, because in many ways they were the most mistreated by the former regime, although the Kurds were also very badly treated. And the Kurds still remain, for the most part, quite supportive of our activity. The Shia were losing ground in quickly. It's a very complicated community, and in questions and answers we can try to dig into why it is that Muqtadir al-Sadr has support, and why he's being accused, and probably, in my view, was associated with the murder of Ayatollah Khomeini. And we can try to ferret out the differences among these various Shia Ayatollahs, the most important being Sadr's father, and now Muqtadir, and Hakim, also a man who was murdered, and Khomeini, who was murdered. And what all this means for the United States, I think one moral of the story for all of us is we've entered a very complex social environment where we're seen now as the kingmaker, and in many ways we are the kingmaker. We're both blamed for whoever gets power inside that struggle, and also seen as the route to power for a number of these players, which make it very difficult for us to extract ourselves from the political game inside Iraq, which is what I want to talk to you about next. One of the most discouraging things that we've seen in the last month is that the U.S.-trained Iraqi security forces, and we did send an envoy of President Bush, his name was Walter Slocum, and he happened to be at Mershan just 3 weeks ago, to organize the army in Iraq. And, you know, he thought he'd done a reasonable job. It turns out that in Fallujah, 100% of the Iraqi forces we had mobilized and trained defected. In the south, around Karbala, well more than 50% have defected, and nearly all refused to fight. We're starting over again the last 10 days or so to try to rebuild a different Iraqi army, this time with Iraqi commanders, some of whom, in fact, the most prominent leaders of which were important generals for Saddam Hussein. And we've had some false starts then, again, like the complex Shia community. We first named a particular general, then discovered that everyone in Iraq understood what he was associated with, which was some very unsavory things in the past. So we changed gears and put a different guy in charge. And we're trying to slowly build up an Iraqi-led army that will control Fallujah, in some ways pull back and allow the Iraqis to do this themselves. Who knows where that goes? It's not at all clear what the loyalty to us of these Iraqis we're putting in power is. Political scientists who study war always argue that building peace is a lot harder than winning the military fight on the battlefield. And translating military success into political success is what the United States was never able to do in Vietnam, and it's what is in front of us here, and it's really hard. Let me talk about why that's so hard and if there's a roadmap forward for us to be successful. There's no question that on the military battlefield we can win, whatever that means, meaning we can accomplish very specific military missions. We have overwhelming superiority in military firepower. We're not trying, however, to kill all the Iraqis. We're trying to actually do those three things I started with and leave a state there that would be more pro-American or at least not hostile to American and less likely to fund anti-American forces in the Middle East than when we started. And if we don't accomplish that, much of this was for naught. We were never seen by most Iraqis as doing this for some sort of selfless, altruistic reason because we thought Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. The CNN and USA Today did a poll in Iraq 10 days ago of 3,300 Iraqis in 17 provinces. The only province they didn't go into was Kurdistan, obviously, oddly, I should say, in the north. I think they already knew sentiment pro-American there is very strong. And what they found, of course, is that vast majorities, 75% plus, feel we came to Iraq for basically two reasons: to take their oil and to weaken an Arab state and put an American military presence in the Middle East that would pressure Saudi Arabia on oil issues, relieve us in the long run of dependency on Saudi Arabian oil, and provide for Israel an ally in the region that would allow Israel through superior force to simply crush the Palestinian resistance. Now, whether we intended to do all those things or not, that's clearly what most Iraqis, in fact most Arabs, are absolutely certain we went there to accomplish. And they believe we're well on the way to accomplishing those three things. And of course, then it fuels their resistance. They are afraid, in fact not afraid, they seem confident in their knowledge, that we're going to act through local clients because that's our modus operandi in the Middle East, in their mind, over the past 50 years. Find usually traditional elites or the elites that we're now empowering in the new Iraqi army who come from a variety of backgrounds, usually not very democratic, who can basically enforce our will for us in the region for some kind of payoff in terms of their personal gain in the area. Now, we created a council of 25 Iraqis that we picked out. Most of them, by serving in that council, two, of course, have been assassinated. But the rest are all suspect of somehow being these agents that we're buying and paying for and who will do our bidding rather than the bidding of the Iraqi regime. Our government's quite aware that that's the perceptual problem we face. And their strategy for dealing with it was this: that we would set up a transition strategy where this Council of 25 would never be called a government. It would simply set up an electoral process to elect people. But to do that, it would have to write a constitution. And that was the rub this past winter. The most important Ayatollah, one who I haven't mentioned yet, Ayatollah Sistani, objected to the idea of having a constitution written by U.S.-appointed clients, these 25 or any other 25, and said there needs to be an election to a constitutional convention. And then that constitutional convention should write the constitution and organize another election that would begin the new era of Iraqi governance. Now, he's quite confident if you get to an election, his people are going to come out way ahead in any electoral process that goes forward. And in fact, so are the people in the council loyal to us, quite confident that if you go to that electoral route, Sistani and the organized clerics will come out way ahead. And they've resisted that very strongly, and we've supported their resistance. And we've tried a variety of different ways to come up and square this circle. About a month ago, now maybe two, we agreed and asked the United Nations to help us, to send an envoy to negotiate with Sistani, who won't meet with us or any of our envoys, and meet with the Iraqi council and see if he could find a middle ground for this electoral conundrum so that we could start this process of transition to where it doesn't look like an American client government, but it's an Iraqi government. And this man's name is Brahimi, has come up with a proposal, which is for the United Nations to name a temporary government, not this council, a government of maybe only a dozen people, maybe fewer, that the UN would legitimate as bureaucratic, technocratic placeholders whose only purpose would be to organize an election to be completed by a year from now, late spring next year, 05. And we have liked a lot about that plan, although we haven't bought onto it altogether, because we would like to have some say over who the people are that get anointed in this transition government. And Brahimi says that has to be the privilege of the United Nations. But we're closer on that than we've been in a long time to coming up with that process. There are 100 technical issues we can talk about. If you're going to have elections, should there be elections that allow parties to run? And the way that would be is when people go to vote, do they vote for a party or do they vote for an individual? Now, a lot of these individuals in this council that we named are in some ways faceless for most Iraqis. They think if you allow parties to run, at least the name of their organization will draw lots of votes. Sistani is quite confident that if you allow individual, particularly clerical leaders, to put their name on the ballot, vote for Mr. Smith or Jones, they'll win because those names will be known, much more so than the faceless members on the council. And we've been arguing over whether you'll allow these sort of lists to vote or individuals to vote, but these are details. The current plan is this, that a transitional government, and the U.S. has not quite bought into whether it's the 25 that we've anointed or the 6 to 10 that the U.N. will agree to, but they've got exactly 2 months or so, now only 6 weeks. By July 1, that's supposed to be resolved, and whichever one it is becomes the government. And they have about a year, a little less, 10 months, to organize elections. And what those elections will be to is a constitutional assembly whose purpose in 05 and 06 will be to write a constitution and hold another set of elections. And hopefully those second sets of elections will create a government and Iraq goes forward. So let me finish with the puzzle that's in front of us now. In the meantime, who and what institutions will maintain order in society? Who will control the economic resources over the next 14 to 18 months? Who's going to assure that any of this process keeps going forward? Because it's quite likely that if given their own devices, the Iraqis would stop this process as the Council of 25 has already proposed. Why bother with any elections at all? We'll just be the government. And let's leave it be at that. We've resisted that because we're quite aware they're seeing too much as our creation and would lack legitimacy. And there basically are three options that are being fought over right now politically as how we go forward over the next year and a half. One option is the United States stays. On July 1, we switch a little bit from an occupying force to a force that's there at the invitation, presumably the Iraqi government, but the Iraqi government has no option to ask us to leave. So it's not exactly a free Iraqi government, and it's Iraqi government that also doesn't control its own Ministry of Finance or Defense or some of the other things, but there are other experiences in the colonial past of the Middle East where there are nominally independent governments where the great power pulls a lot of the strings, and that goes on for a year or so, and hopefully our forces reduce in number as an Iraqi army comes on And look, Iraqis do know how to repress and police each other. They've had a lot of practice at that. They simply won't do it for a government that they consider to be American. So the puzzle is how you get a government that they don't see as so American, and one that has any hope of becoming representative in some sort of democratic governing process. There are real problems with leaving the U.S. in charge, and we're seeing them on TV every night. It's very expensive. $87 billion last year, $25 billion in an immediate appropriation right now, and who knows how much as the next year unfolds. We're racing, unfortunately, towards 800 American killed, thousands injured and maimed. We don't even count on the Iraqi side. And the resistance, as I said when I started, is going up, not going down. So the trend lines are all in the wrong direction in terms of that issue. We lack legitimacy. We're not seen as an agent who can bring democracy, whoever intended to bring democracy, or whoever has supported democracy in the Middle East. There's no history of America supporting democracy in the Arab or the Muslim world more generally. Now, we can change and say now we're going to, but in the minds of most people living there, they know we never have, and they're deeply suspicious, and these prison pictures that I suspect Mary Ellen will refer to some don't help our case at all. The Iraqi option, we just get out and let whatever follows follow. It's not even clear if that's possible. Certainly, if we get out very quickly, there'll be a surge for power among all the contenders right now. And a number of those groups are pretty heavily armed. And it's not at all unlikely that you would get civil war. And in the midst of that civil war, Turkey might intervene to be sure that the Kurds don't succeed in the north. The Shia will be very nervous that Saudi Arabia might do something to stop a Shia government from coming to power in Iraq. One of the real complexities here is that most Arab states are Sunni dominated. And so many Iraqis are not enthusiastic if they're Shia about having other Sunni Arab governments, particularly the Saudi Arabian one, a fundamentalist Sunni government, come to help out policing in Iraq. So just as we're not very popular there, it's not as all clear to me that large Sunni government Arab states are going to be any more popular there. If we pull out very quickly, it'll also look as if we were defeated and are running. That might actually lead to more attacks on us, not only in the Middle East, but elsewhere, because it'll convince many that what made the Americans change their mind is the rising cost of all of this. And since they would prefer us to leave the Middle East as a whole, raise the cost some more. So if we stay, we may generate as much terror as we deter or wipe out. And if we leave, I mean, we've really stepped in it here at this point, and there is no easy exit. Whichever way we go, there's going to be a lot more killing, a lot more fighting. This is not going to be an easy route out of this in any regard. The last option is the international option. Not just Brahimi. Maybe we could appoint, or not we, ask Kofi Annan, to appoint a UN High Commissioner. There's an experience with that in other countries, Cambodia just a decade ago. Let that UN High Commissioner come in with the legitimacy of the United Nations, the European Union, the Arab League, whatever it takes. Let the High Commissioner come in also with authority to appoint a transition team of technocrats to manage this constitutional election. The only way I can imagine that Iraqis would be assured that we're not going to exploit them for our personal interest, our own self-interest, is if there were other powerful states in there checking and balancing our control over the situation. Those are the Europeans, the Russians. The Russians have a leader, a guy named Yevgeny Primakov. Maybe he could come and help us. A lot of Iraqis know that name. I could imagine some kind of international group Iraqis aren't going to be very enthusiastic about that either. They'd like their own sovereignty, but at least if it was checked and balanced by different players. The difficulty for this one is, who's going to come to help us? Given the circumstance that we now face. Because you're now not asking your soldiers to come in and help police a ceasefire. You're asking them to come into what looks like a burgeoning civil war, or war of resistance and liberation. And they very well may. The Iraqi resistance, of course, has been targeting the forces of all those who've come to play with us, and particularly trying to split off us from any possible allies that we've had in this conflict. Well, other allies may be very reticent to come. They will be very reticent to come unless they have a genuine control over what's going to happen. And so far, that's been a non-starter with the Bush administration. They're not prepared to surrender the control over events, say over the Ministry of Oil, the Ministry of Defense, sufficiently to convince the NATO allies to come and help us on this. That'll be resolved over the next year, I suppose, but I think I'll stop there.
At a forum not unlike this one, more than a year ago, just before the outbreak of the war, I heard Professor Herman lay out many of the reasons why our country should have been very hesitant to use force in Iraq. And, of course, so many of his fears have come to pass. I really wish he had been more of an alarmist rather than an accurate prophet. But my task tonight is to talk with you about law. Rules and principles intended to guide behavior, whether of the individual or of the nation state. And I'm going to talk with you about the law relevant to our going into Iraq last year, the law relevant to our presence there now, and the law relevant to June 30th and beyond. Because Iraq is a foreign sovereign state, the law relevant to all these phases of U.S. and Iraq interaction is international law. Now, you heard me say the word sovereignty, and you've heard that word bandied about quite a lot in the news in the last months. I'll talk a little bit more about sovereignty when I get to that third phase. But first, let's look at the law on the road to Iraq. Under international law, in particular a binding treaty that you all know well, the United Nations Charter, a state may only use force in very narrow circumstances. It may use force in self-defense if it suffers an armed attack, as Kuwait did in 1990 when Iraq invaded, or as this country did on September 11th and when we defended ourselves against that attack in Afghanistan. In other cases where there is no armed attack, and a state still wishes to use force, it must go to the United Nations Security Council to get authorization. It is on this basis that the Bush administration attempted to justify the use of force in Iraq last year. Our United Nations representative, John Negroponte, sent a letter to the Security Council, as did Britain and Australia, and stated that a combination of Security Council resolutions from 1990 and 91 gave implicit authorization to use force against Iraq in 2003. They asserted that those resolutions allowed the United States to use force to enforce yet another Security Council resolution mandating that Iraq give up all weapons of mass destruction. Now, at no time did the Bush administration ever say that this country was above the law. It never said that no international law binds this country, or that we are no longer a party to the United Nations Charter. On the other hand, the arguments the administration made under that law are at best very weak. It had to cobble together several 12-year-old resolutions that plainly applied to a different time and a different war. In 2002, the Security Council had set about anew to to tackle the problem of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The council members made clear that it would be the council that would decide what further action would be taken in respect to Iraqi weapons. UN weapons inspectors went back to Iraq in December 2002. They did not find evidence of weapons programs. They wanted to continue inspecting. 11 of 15 Security Council members wanted the inspections to continue. On March 17th, the U.S. and the U.K. tried desperately to get that explicit Security Council authorization to allow a lawful use of force in Iraq. They did not get that authorization. They went to war anyway on March 19th. The law governing our presence in Iraq today, regardless of the legality of an initial use of force, an initial decision to use force, international law clearly mandates, and this may be the oldest aspect of international law, that certain basic principles be respected in the conduct of a war or an occupation. This law is found in another set of very well-known treaties, the Hague and Geneva Conventions. This law requires such things as not intentionally targeting non-combatants or their property or their important cultural sites, their churches, their mosques. It also requires commanders to make a basic calculation in deciding on a target. Is the military objective of that target so important that it is worth the cost in civilian lives and property that it may demand? This is the rule of proportionality. As I observed the hostilities from March 19th until May 1st, the end of major hostilities, I thought that the coalition forces did a fairly good job in terms of this basic rule of targeting. Human Rights Watch, however, has a 50-page report that it released in December. You can find it on its website. And it concludes that excessive force was used on a number of occasions in the actual conduct of hostilities, and the result was the disproportionate loss of life and property. I have done a more in-depth investigation into the conduct of the occupation. Here, the United States failed to meet its obligations before it even entered Iraq. To fulfill, an occupying power has obligations to restore and maintain order, stop looting, protect irreplaceable treasures, provide for the basic needs of the population, and ensure the humane treatment of all persons in detention. These are arguably the most important basic principles of occupation. There are others. But to fulfill these basic obligations for a country like Iraq required that the coalition forces send a very large and appropriately trained military force. One RAND Corporation study estimated that for Iraq, a force of 500,000 troops would have been necessary to properly occupy. The Army War College released a very detailed study in December of 2002 explaining exactly what kind of force we needed to send. That is not the force we sent. Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki, testifying before Congress in February 2003, asked about the size of the force we needed to invade Iraq and said the following, and I quote, "Something on the order of several hundred thousand troops. We're talking about post-hostilities control over a piece of geography that's fairly significant, with the kinds of ethnic tensions that could lead to other problems. And so it takes a significant ground force presence to maintain a safe and secure environment, to ensure that people are fed, that water is distributed, all the normal responsibilities that go along with administering a situation like this." Yes, the general said responsibilities, legal responsibilities. General Shinseki knew what our obligations would be in Iraq. The invading force that we actually sent numbered about 120,000. We have just over 130,000 troops in Iraq today. Former Secretary of the Army Thomas White explained why the decision was made to send an inadequate force. Quote, all of us thought a big force was going to be required for quite some time. That's what Shinseki said. That's what I said. It's been Don Rumsfeld's view that the military asks for too much force. Secretary Rumsfeld refused to believe all the experts who said a large force would be needed. But he also refused to take seriously our legal obligations that required a larger and a different force. According to the San Diego Union-Tribune, quote, though Pentagon officials were warned as early as January 2003 and repeatedly since that a U.S. invasion would place, for example, cultural treasures in grave danger, and though international law mandates the protection of artistic treasures in time of war, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made the point again and again that soldiers were not there to stop plunder. But it was in connection with the looting and plunder that Secretary Rumsfeld made his now famous comment, quote, freedom's untidy, and free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes and do bad things. But the Hague regulations state unequivocally that people are not free to commit crimes in an occupation. It is the duty of the occupying power to stop them. If we had had a force big enough or better trained, we could have fulfilled our Hague regulation duties. We did not, and as a result, not only have we lost some of humanity's oldest treasures, we are paying the price dearly for the anarchy that reigned following the invasion in terms of American lives and treasure. Mark Danner, writing in the New York Review of Books, drew this conclusion from the failure to maintain order. The weeks of looting and disorder that followed not only continued the destruction of Iraq's infrastructure, preventing the Americans from supplying the country with electricity and other basic services, more important, the looting and mayhem destroyed American political authority even before it could be established. Such political authority is rooted in the monopoly of legitimate violence, which the Americans, after standing by during weeks of chaos and insecurity, were never able to attain. The story is sadly a similar one inside the detention centers of Iraq. Insufficient troops, the wrong kind of troops, and the wrong priorities from the Pentagon. Army doctrine calls for an MP brigade to handle about 4,000 prisoners. At the now infamous Abu Ghraib prison, a battalion, which is about one-third the size of a brigade, was handling 6,000 to 7,000 prisoners. According to the New York Times, in fact, few of the 1,000 reservists of the 320th had been trained to guard prisoners, and fewer still knew how to run a prison. They were deployed so quickly from the mid-Atlantic region that there was no time to get new lessons. The soldiers found themselves in charge of Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq at a time when the increasing rage of anti-American insurgency, along with the desperation of American commanders to glean intelligence, magnified the pressures on the unit. General Tacuba, who inspected Abu Ghraib, recommended in his March report to the Department of Defense to immediately deploy to the Iraq theater an integrated, multidisciplined, mobile training team comprised of subject matter experts in internment and resettlement operations, international and operational law, information technology, facility management, interrogation and intelligence, chaplains, Arab cultural awareness, all this in March, almost a year after the start of hostilities. This team needs to oversee and conduct comprehensive training in all aspects of detainee and confinement operations. A New York Times columnist has said that the Rumsfeld Doctrine should be considered the use of underwhelming force to achieve overwhelming goals. For me, the Rumsfeld Doctrine is the use of underwhelming force to create overwhelming problems. The result of the disorder at the outset of the occupation and now the detainee abuse scandals have created a huge problem for us in ever leaving Iraq, as we heard Professor Herman say. This leads me to my third and final phase, the law on the road home. On June 30th, the Bush administration has said that it will, quote, hand back sovereignty to the Iraqis, or at least limited sovereignty. But this country never took sovereignty. The Bush administration never purported to conquer Iraq, to turn it into the 53rd U.S. state or into a colony. And so that was something good. But we did, what we did was to take over as an occupying power governmental control. And we plan to give some governmental control back to Iraqis on June 30th. But it seems to me that it will not be enough for purposes of international law to actually change our status away from one of an occupying power to one of a country there by the consent of a governing authority. We have heard from numerous Bush administration officials that if the Iraqi government tells us, or the new Iraqi interim governing authority tells us to leave, we will not. And as long as we do not leave at their request, we will remain under international law an occupying power with all of the obligations an occupying power has that I have already mentioned to you this evening. Could we simply leave? Secretary Powell apparently warned President Bush that if we invade Iraq, we would have to follow Pottery Barn rules. You break it, you own it. Under international law, in fact, we can break it and we can walk away and leave the pieces behind. We may still have to pay for the pieces one day, but we don't have to own it. Attempts will be made to get the United States to pay, and those attempts have already started. Lawyers in the United Kingdom have already sued the British government for torturing persons in their detention. American lawyers are already planning, already representing victims and thinking of ways that they can get around American governmental immunity to get compensation on behalf of individuals. Someday the world may demand the same kind of reparations from the United States that Iraq was made to pay for invading and violating the laws of armed conflict in Kuwait. If we stay, we need to do the right thing immediately. It's time for strict compliance with the Geneva and Hague regulations wherever U.S. military personnel serve. And that means Afghanistan and Cuba, too. Whether we stay or go, I suggest we learn again the lesson of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. After that tragedy, this nation recommitted to the rule of law. We vastly revamped and upgraded the training of our military personnel. I know that because my husband was one of those personnel. He was an interrogator for the United States military for over 11 years, and there's nobody who knows the Geneva Conventions better than he does. But for any training or recommitment to the rule of law to be effective, we need our national leaders to say that they believe in this law, that each of them is personally committed to the Geneva and Hague regulations. They need to create the informal respect for the law that gives it the priority it needs to influence behavior by everyone in our nation and in our armed services. We've heard apologies, but we have not yet heard our national leaders say that they are committed to the full implementation and respect for the Geneva Conventions and the Hague regulations. And yet this country has always stood for the rule of law. Benjamin Franklin signed the first important bilateral treaty on the humane treatment of prisoners in 1785 with Prussia. Let's return to this most important principle in our nation's history.
I don't know if I can talk without waving my arms around, but I'll try. I guess I have to hold on to this thing. My job is to talk about the invasion and occupation from the perspective of the Iraqi people. I think that I was asked to do this because I've lived for a long time in the Arab world. I've lived with Muslim families. I see the human face of the Iraqis who are suffering so much at this time. There's several things I may be saying at the beginning here that are perhaps things that seem obvious to most people in this room, but in case they aren't, I want to mention them. There's kind of a dark humor that goes along, and as a folklorist, I can't help but notice this dark humor. I heard on Garrison Keillor the other day that the United States government knows for sure that the Iraqis have weapons of mass destruction because we have the receipts. This is the kind of, touchstone that I think we need to talk about more in the general news when we're talking about the situation in Iraq. Saddam Hussein is, as an Iraqi told me today, American-made. It's not a question of an evil person coming and we all of a sudden noticed, oh, there's this evil person here and now we're going to rush in and save the Iraqi people. No. He was our great good friend for most of the 1980s when things like the murder of the Kurds happened. We tisked a bit, but he was still our great good friend as long as he was fighting from 1980 to 1988 the Iranians for us. If you want to talk about evil, and I really suggest that we should not use that word in a public university with the implications for, the evildoers that we hear so much about on the news these days, then that, if you want to change the word to something like unethical or immoral, something like that, there's a lot of that going around. That's certainly not something that we can just lay in the lap of Saddam Hussein. We had lucrative economic contracts with that country, and we wanted to keep those contracts. Another piece of dark humor that I've heard that's very relevant today, probably most of you have heard this because I've heard it a couple times, is in terms of the prison, the torture chambers in Abu Ghraib. They're not shut down, they're just under new management. Sad, but true. That's what we're finding out. Okay, the other thing that I think, way that I think I can put a human face a little bit on the Iraqi situation is just to talk about the kind of difference that Iraqis are able to make, and maybe a lot of Americans are not quite so able to make, between the Iraqi people and the Iraqi government and the, someone like Saddam Hussein. I was last year, when the war started, I woke up the first day I went to Egypt to give I was presenting a paper in a conference in Alexandria, Egypt. My son was with me. He's 16, 17 now. We woke up in Alexandria to find out that the war had started. My son likes Egypt a lot. He's not one to stay home at night, even though I am. And so with some trepidation, I saw him going out into the nightlife of Cairo. And luckily, I guess now I hadn't even realized it at the time, but he had spent a lot of time demonstrating against the war before it ever started. And I said, well, what did people say? Did you say that you were an American? And he said, well, yes. He said people would come up to me, guys his age or older, in their 20s, and say, are you German? And he would say, no. Are you British? No, I'm American. I like your button. If he had a great big no war button on. So, he didn't, in fact, he was told, he was warned a few times, you be careful if you, in other words, watch out. It's not like everyone might be, understanding as we are about the fact that the American government and Americans are not the same thing. So when I'm talking about the situation with the American-made Saddam Hussein, one of the cautions that I'd like to offer is just to be sure, and I'm trying to be sure too, that you get the many different kinds of contexts to the situation. Historical contexts of various lengths. If you go onto the website for the Manchester, I'm dating myself, but the Guardian, the British newspaper, they have links to all kinds of historical sites and timelines and articles that were actually written at different points that, from way back in the, 1914, 1916, that had to do with Iraq. So I think also to look at some of the other sites that were mentioned, that you can go look at Save the Children, you can look at the Red Cross sites, you can look at Amnesty International sites, and get a much broader perspective about the situation than we get, I think, in our sound bites here in the United States. Another thing that I hope that I could put a face on the Iraqi people is that there is no clash of civilization. I mean, I lived with Muslims in their house, for years and years. It's only a theory for somebody who really hasn't spent any time living in the Muslim world. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later too. A very huge context that I want to mention is the context of Iraq itself. Iraq doesn't have the same kinds of issues that we have here as Americans. Iraq is thousands of years old. Iraq has both the challenges, the positives and the negatives of having to try to figure out how to work out a life for themselves that really has a history that goes back, to Babylon. So, it's not, we can't just take something that we have here and decide that it'll work in Iraq. It's not the same kind of place. Another thing that a lot of these ideas, Professor Salah Mehdi is here, who's a Fulbright professor from Iraq, so I had a good long talk with him today, but also some of my ideas are coming from Juan Cole, who's a professor at University of Michigan, and also Fred Holliday. I teach a class called Why Do They Hate Us? And I use a book that he wrote for that class. I use a book that's called 2 Hours That Shook the World, where he talks a lot about, I think quite subtly, about this, what led up to the Twin Towers situation. The other thing that probably everyone here already knows is that Iraq was far from having anything to do with 9/11. And I think out of duplicity or maybe just carelessness, where we were never sort of disabused of the notion that Iraq somehow caused 9/11. Okay. And then, of course, the idea that terrorism is not an Arab issue or a Muslim issue, that there's terrorism from above, which is what Holliday talks about, some of which has been caused by us, terrorism by nation states, as well as terrorism from below. Probably the biggest danger that we've caused in Iraq is one that's really hard to fix because it depends on almost every American in Iraq deciding not anymore to be arrogant, to practice humiliation with the Iraqis, to understand that they're equals, that the dehumanizing language that we hear apply to them doesn't mean then that you can think of them as dogs and put chains around their necks. The kind of news reporting we get where we hear every single American that's killed, and we don't know, we have no idea how many Iraqi civilians have been killed, men, women, and children. So I think that, I'm not sure how that can be solved, but I just wanted to mention it. Some other misconceptions that are going on, that in women's issues, you read in the paper all the time that women have now somehow become free in Iraq. Women were doing pretty well in Iraq already. ALFI, the Organization of Women's Freedom in Baghdad, reports, though, that 400 women have been raped between April and August of last year. The women are now having trouble going to work or to college because the streets are too dangerous. They did, in fact, go to work and to college. Some women wear hijab, some women don't. Okay. The other thing that I think that we really have to try to avoid there is misunderstanding the situation that religion plays in Iraq. On one hand, I think we have to really be careful about the idea of divide and conquer. We have to be really careful that people are not turning other people in, accusing them of being bosses and the Americans, because we don't speak the language and we have very little entree into the Iraqi social order. Don't know that, in fact, sometimes people are turning other people in out of some kind of tribal revenge or some kind of sectarian revenge. It has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that they might have been bosses or that they were all involved with any kind of attacks on Americans. The other thing is that as far as the religious situation, you heard, at least you heard Professor Herman talk about Sistani and also about Mukhtar al-Sadr. It seems to me, Sistani is is what's called a quietist Shiite. That is, that he does not think that he should be a politician. He does not think even, he's sort of a pro-choice, although extremely conservative, Shiite cleric. But he doesn't think that there should people, women should be forced to wear hijab. He doesn't think that people should be forced to not drink alcohol. He doesn't. No, these are. This is the kind of difference between Sistani, who actually is an older man and actually a very well-respected cleric, and Mukhtar al-Sadr, who is a young guy, about 30 years old. He's as we talked about today, he's ADD. He really hasn't finished his schooling in terms of religious law. He's the one that you might have heard about whose newspaper was canceled by the Americans. And this newspaper, Al Hausa, that came out once a week, it's more like a pamphlet really than a newspaper, had about 10,000 circulation. He has his authority from the fact, really, that his father was such, and grandfather were both very well respected. And they were both murdered, as was his father's sister, his aunt. But even though Mukhtar al-Sadr is somewhat at odds with Sistani, there is no way that Sistani would want Mukhtar al-Sadr picked up and put in prison by the Americans. And I, you know, at this point, we're right on the edge of maybe and maybe not negotiating with Mukhtar al-Sadr, and I really hope that we do that. We talked a little bit about getting out of Iraq, and I think this might be a question more for Professor Herman than for me, but I'm not sure which one of you guys, but the thing is that we've never successfully nudged a country into stability and something like democracy, except if we stayed a long time, like Germany, like Japan, like South Korea. So the opposite of getting out is, are we getting out for the right reasons? I mean, are we getting out because there's an election coming, and so we're afraid that, you know, our president's afraid of, he won't be reelected if we're still there? I mean, I think we have to, you know, sort of put those thoughts aside and try to figure out, really, along with the Iraqis, what's the best thing. I personally, can you imagine us now having another power right here in Columbus, and not wanting them to leave, and not doing everything you could to get them gone? I can't. When I was in college, we did not take world civilization. We took Western civilization. And I'm thinking that maybe part of the problem that we have right now is that a lot of our leaders also took Western civilization. They're my age or, you know, maybe a bit around my age anyway. And I'm thinking that this is the problem that I heard, for example, that Wolfowitz didn't seem to think that the Shiites in Iraq were secular, and also he didn't seem to have any idea, the quote I guess was something to do with, well, we won't have the same problems in Iraq as we do in Saudi Arabia because there's no holy cities in Iraq. So, I mean, I think this is this is part of the problem we have to move on now and make sure that we're doing better international education in this country. We, in fact, have the idea, I think, that Iraqi nationalism is not possible in Iraq, that we certainly in the West are disregarding the fact that Iraq has been a country since 1932. During the Iran-Iraq War in 1980-88, relatively few Shiites went to Iran. They fought for Iraq. During this bombing in Fallujah last week, both the Sunnis and the Qassaniyas and the Asamiya territories, one is Sunni and one is Shiite, in Baghdad, went banded together and took 60 truckloads of food and supplies and blood to Fallujah. So definitely there's a feeling of solidarity that transcends religion. As far as what to do about the elections, I think, one Cole suggested that he thought that, something I read, that he thought that the best idea would be maybe to have two houses just like we do here, a Senate and a Congress, and that way that would balance the problem that didn't even seem to occur to anybody for quite a long time of majority rule and minority rights. So instead of having this funny idea of having a president and two vice presidents or three presidents, all from different religious parties, which already was tried by the French in Lebanon and really only worked when Lebanon was doing fine and fell apart after that. So I just want to end by talking about, by mentioning the fact that now in the College of Humanities, we did a study that was a Homeland Security study, and what we decided to do, or I was just peripherally involved, but what Jackie Royster and the college decided to do was to talk about the ways that long-term homeland security, long-term world security, you know, if we're going to be citizens, of the world now and just citizens of the United States, really depends on languages, learning languages, learning about different religions, traveling to different parts of the world, starting international education much younger for kids, using a lot of the technology we have now maybe to have contacts with people, college students. Last fall I did a conference, a video conference, a live video conference with students in Tunisia, in North Africa, Arab students there. And we watched a movie and then we all discussed it together. I mean, I think that if we can do some of those things so that we can put a human face, and we can't be fooled by people who are more ignorant into thinking that these people somehow are less worthy than we are or want different things than we do, and maybe then the 21st century will not be quite so bloody as the 20th century was. Thanks.